And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Here at Quark's, customer satisfaction is our primary concern.
I'd say we just found our way into a wormhole.
I'm Kira Nerys.
Lieutenant Commander Worf, reporting for duty, sir.
You're the best crew any captain ever had. This may be the last time we're all together.
This will shortly become a leading center of commerce and of scientific exploration. And for Starfleet, one of our most important posts.
It is quite simply, Commander. The journey you have always been destined to take.
Sensors are not functioning.
We've lost all contact with the space station.
What the hell is happening out there?
Shields up. Damage report.
Battle stations.
I'm Captain Benjamin Sisko. Welcome to Deep Space Nine.
Listen to the prophets. A Deep Space Nine Two True Freaks presentation with Sean Engel and Andrew Layla.
And now with 100% more Paul Spataro.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a Justified podcast. Raylan Givens is back with an all-new sixth season coming. What? We're not doing that show? You mean we don't do a podcast about Justified and Raylan Givens?
Why the hell not?
That's after we should totally do a Justified podcast.
Oh, all right then. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Listen to the Prophet, a Deep Space Nine podcast brought to you by Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. As usual, myself and my two cohorts will journey through an episode of Deep Space Nine, telling you the good, the bad, and the downright ugly. I am Andrew Leyland, and as ever, I am joined by the illustrious Paul Spataro.
Good morning.
And the mighty Sean Engel. You alright, folks?
Good evening.
Good morning, good evening, good night, and God bless.
We should totally do a Justified podcast. We call it Fire in the Hole.
Oh, brilliant title. Down with that.
I'm going to catch up on the later seasons. I think I've watched all through season 3, and I need to check out the rest of them. I know it's coming up on the final season. They're starting to air it. So I need to catch up on that quick.
Yeah, Justified is my favorite show currently on the air. Oh, no.
Mm-hmm. Well, ever since... Well, no, I'm Game of Thrones is my...
My heroes have always been cowboys. So,
all right, Willie Nelson.
It's time to break out of the song. I do have to thank you guys for getting me into Breaking Bad over the Christmas holiday. I started watching that on Netflix, and I'm up to season 2. I got through season 1. It's great. I'm loving the heck out of it. So, thank you for getting me into that.
And it only gets better.
I know.
It does, yeah. It just gets better and better as it goes. It's one of those that just starts brilliantly and improves as it goes along. But public thank you for my little doll of Heisenberg. Thank you very much.
And for my Walter White, because he's not Heisenberg yet. Mine standing there in his tidy whities. Of course, you did open the door to, it's not as if I don't have enough shelf porn in my house. having seen that, I ended up with a little supply of pop figures for Christmas now. I have the Jon Snow from Game of Thrones.
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
I got the Jesse Pinkman.
Oh, right, I thought you were going to say from the Disney Channel. Hey, Jesse!
No.
So you've not got a doll of Debbie Ryan, that's what you're saying.
I'm a little embarrassed right now that I do a show with somebody who knows who stars in Jesse.
I have an 11-year-old daughter, dude.
I understand that I'm still embarrassed before. I also got the Groot and Rocket pop figures.
Pretty sure the answer to this question is going to be, I am Groot. But who bought you all these? Give them a shout-out.
Oh, that's... one was from Sean, and then my kids were a couple of the others, and then I bought one.
You didn't buy yourself a Star Trek one, then?
Not yet. I mean, that's the problem is, there's only so much space for the shelf porn. I am running low on space. It's funny, I have this is not a Star Trek thing, but I have so many things around here, and some of the ones I have are the little statues. They're almost type the Hummel type statues, but they're not boring and dull like that. They're from the Three Little Pigs from Walt Disney.
Yay!
But they're that size, and I have the wolf, and I had two of the Three Little Pigs, and for Christmas I got the third little pig. And somebody purchased it for me on eBay, and when they gave it to me, they were like, "Oh, it doesn't have the certificate of authenticity," and I was like, "Well, really? Because you know, like, do I need a certificate to tell me that's the third little pig?" You know, I think people take the collecting of this stuff too seriously.
Well, we've been keeping him quiet because we wanted it to be a very special surprise. But the fourth member, the unofficial fourth member of the Listen to the Prophets crew, has Ryan also Epstein. Joined us, yes, for this week's episode. Say hello, Dr. Bill.
Hello.
Yay. And you notice we brought him in there seamlessly. Yeah, anyone would think this was a professional job.
Yeah, just keep thinking that. eventually it'll happen. Sure, why not?
Eventually it will happen. How are you, Bill?
Oh, wonderful. Super. I returned home this morning to be greeted by Alvin Lecter, patiently waiting for me to feed him as I walked through the door.
I thought he was going to stab you as you walked in and then eat you.
I wasn't sure, because when I opened the door, there was a light on from a hallway, and the cat's sitting there in silhouette only, and it's like, "Hello, Dr. Bill."
You look like a well-scrubbed
Was it not more of a, "I have been expecting you, Mr. Robinson"?
Yes, it's like, "Feed me now." So it's like, right. Well, I better feed him or I will get no peace during the podcast. So.
No. All right, get him fed. do we have any Star Trek news before we start this episode? The only thing I've got, and so I can publicly thank Paul, as I have Sean, is I got a package in the mail just before Christmas, and it had, as part of a bunch of catalogues from the New York Comic Con, thanks Paul, it had a preview of Star Trek Planet of the Apes, which had a gorgeous George Perez cover. And it was interesting. It's only the first 5 pages, obviously. But it did solidify my opinion to wait for the trade on this, because it didn't take me but 30 seconds to read those 5 pages.
Mm. Now, you know what? You answered my question before I had a chance to ask it. I was waiting patiently to ask it, and you answered it.
Sorry.
I did pick up the first issue, and I read it. And I would say I'm going to be picking them up as they come out, just because it's Star Trek Meets Planet of the Apes.
But it's good.
Yeah, I agree with you. It looks like it's better served than the trade.
But it is good.
Yeah, oh, it's good. I enjoyed it so far. I mean, it's good if you take the position that it's going to continue to build and get you somewhere. Now, if it ends up being a road to nowhere, then I'm not going to enjoy it.
Right.
Yeah, IDW, you know, with their Star Trek thing... The last thing that I read from IDW crossover with Star Trek was the Star Trek Doctor Who thing, and it started out really well and just kind of petered off after a while. So
yeah, that's my only fear. Tom Baker meets Captain Kirk issue, which is brilliant.
Well, the first issue is pretty much a Star. You know, there's a little Planet of the Apes in it, but it's pretty much a Star Trek issue, and it's building up to them meeting up with the Planet, you know, the Apes and all.
Well, and so. The same time, isn't it written by Scott and David Tipton, who did the Doctor Who Star Trek Next Generation crossover?
Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. So hopefully we won't see the same sort of falling off near the end of the series. Hopefully it'll maintain throughout the entire run of it, so it'll be a good trade to pick up.
Are they drawing Shatner Kirk or Pine Kirk?
Shatner.
It looks to be Shatner. And it's it also, just from... an advanced preview, because we didn't get that far yet. It looks like that we will be seeing George Taylor from the original movie.
Nice.
Taylor.
Well, the only other Star Trek news that I had was they finally, you know, we talked about this like it was probably a couple episodes ago, that they were looking for a new director for the next Star Trek movie, for the Star Trek 3. And... we were thinking it was going to be Jonathan Frakes. Joe Cornish was also mentioned, but they finally came down.
Let's be fair. We were hoping it was going to be Jonathan Frakes. Yes. We really didn't think it.
Well, no. he had put his name out, and he had kind of made some effort to try and make him be the one who was going to be the director. But they finally settled on someone named Justin Lin. Is that right, Justin Lin?
Mm-hmm.
And he is the director of, I think, the 4th and the 6th Fast and the Furious movie. Now, that may kind of get people feeling kind of, I don't know, kind of nervous about how the direction of the new Star Trek movie is. But I know that Tom DJ, who's a friend of all of ours, who's been on a lot of the shows with all of us, has a great affinity for the Fast and the Furious movies, and especially the movies directed by Justin Lin. He said that he's really enamored with his directing style. So I'm hoping that him as a director is a good thing for this. I'm still holding out to see who's writing, because I've also heard during the time that Roberto Orci is completely off Star Trek. He's not writing, he's not directing, he's not producing, he's completely out. So J.J. Abrams is out, Roberto Orci is out. If they can get a good writer who can write Star Trek for the next movie, I think, you know, I don't mind Star Trek being a little actiony, especially with this newer, younger cast, but I want a good story, and I'm hoping, you know, when they finally settle on who they're going to get to write the movie, then I'll be more interested in it.
Well, I heard the reason that those guys are out is they watched Guardians of the Galaxy and said, we want more of that, which kind of makes me a bit uneasy, because Guardians is brilliant, but it's more Farscape, the movie, than it's Star Trek. Well, in fact, you can take those characters and analog them to their Farscape equivalent, and that movie still works.
Yeah, well, and it's also very Star Wars, so, and that's kind of what you felt, a lot of people felt Abrams was trying to do with Star Trek. The original, or the two that he did, was trying to make it more like Star Wars, more action-y. And I don't mind Star Trek having some action beats in it, but it needs to have more science in it. It needs to have more intellectualism. It doesn't need to be a brainless movie. You know, the thing that Kurtzman and Orci are known for writing are the Transformer movies. And those are just big, explodey. Well, I won't disagree.
I thought the first one was okay.
Oh, I hated it.
It's
sorry, but I did, and I hate Pirates of the Caribbean as well.
It's just
I thought the first one was okay.
Hated it.
You know what?
It's no Jaws.
It's very
definitely no Jaws. But they need to have a bit of cerebral level of, you know, intellectualism in a Star Trek movie. You can have moments where the ships are fighting, or where, you know, Kirk and Spock are running around and doing stuff, but there needs to be a better story than what we've seen in the past couple of movies. That's all. That's what I'm hoping for. When they get a writer,
I would
down,
tend to agree with you on that. I would say, you know, I like the action beats. I want the action beats. Not even I can deal with them. I want them. I think that they're well served. We were talking before we went on about Star Trek III. I think Star Trek III combines a lot of that and has some really good action beats in it, but then you also have this, you know, you have a little bit of the science with the Katra and trying to combine Kirk and the planet aging and all of that stuff. So I thought, you know, that they did combine a lot of that, and it can be done clearly, and it can be done well. So I really would like that. I don't want them to make a movie that's so cerebral that it caters just to the hardcore Star Trek fans and loses its overall audience, and then they start going back to the problems that we've had in the past where they start cutting the budget every time.
Yeah.
So I do want something that's going to be popular, but you don't necessarily have to sacrifice quality for popular. The two are not mutually exclusive.
No. Well, I didn't recognize the name until Paul just sent us the IMDb link, and he's directed a couple of Fast and the Furious movies, which is good because I like the Fast and the Furious movies. But my thing here, he directed the first two episodes of True Detective. True Detective was one of the best shows of last year.
Now, see, I haven't seen any of True Detective, but everyone who I've talked to who's seen it has said that it is a phenomenal show. So if he has that kind of talent behind him, I don't have a problem with him directing the Star Trek movie. Like
right,
I said,
well, we haven't actually seen his episode yet. He's directed the first two episodes of season 2.
He's doing season 2. Okay.
So that shows potential if the True Detective guys think that, because he seems to be one of those directors who vacillates between TV and film, which is probably good because it helps you keep the budget under control. He directed the pilot for Scorpion. I don't know what that is because I've never seen it.
It's what is it? It's a CBS show. It's
got Robert Patrick in it, doesn't it?
Oh, I'm lying to you. I saw the pilot episode, and I didn't think it was that great. Oh, that doesn't go. Yeah, sorry about that.
It's like the ragtag group of nerds.
It's the group of nerds hired by the FBI.
I don't see Robert Patrick listed here. I'm just looking at the IMDb page.
Yeah, Robert Patrick is in the pilot. I remember that. I don't know if he's a series regular. He may be. Oh yeah, IMDb says he's in 14 episodes, so that implies he's in the series.
Where am I missing him? All right, whatever. Oh, there you go. Yeah, he's about fifth or sixth down.
He's the and credit, isn't he? And Robert Patrick.
Oh, he just finished his run on Sons of Anarchy, so he had to do something.
Yeah, okay. Justin Lin, thumbs up, tentatively.
I just say the jury's out because I haven't seen anything that he directed, so I have no idea what his sensibilities are.
Yeah, same here on that, because I've only caught, like, I think the first two or three of those of the Fast and Furious movies, so...
Oh, Fast and the Furious, the first one, man, has one of the most heartbreaking scenes in any film. I cried, I broke down and wept when they killed that 1970 Dodge Charger. I was so upset.
I was going to say, I'm like, it had to have been one of the cars got wrecked, because I don't remember anything else that really touched me as much. Oh, Dodge Charger. Oh, sorry. I gotta go.
I'm just looking at his credits, and, you know, I do like when a director has enough gravitas that they write also. And then there's always the danger that they try to take it their own direction and they, you know, they forego what the show is all about to get to what they want to do. But I'm seeing he's got 5 writing credits, the most recent of which is 2007. So he may be one of these guys who's not big on writing himself and might just take whatever he's given and, you know, just adapt it for the screen and put it on, as opposed to putting his own stamp on it. So that could be good or bad, depending on what his take is. And I'm not sure where I'm leading that to. I'm kind of going around in a second.
It is just a case of wait and see, isn't it? It's not a tried and true person, but then neither was Nick Mayer and Harve Bennett.
Mm-hmm. That is true, and they, I always remember, like, the talk about the first thing they did was they sat down and watched every episode of the series to see what made it great and what can they pull from that to put into the movies.
Yeah, as opposed to J.J. Abrams, who watched every episode of the series to finally say, no, it was too smart for me, I'm going to make it what I want to make it. Anyway,
I thought we weren't going to bash J.J. Abrams anymore. We're just going to let that go. He's done his bit. Let's see how he does on Star Wars and go with that.
So, Boobgate. I see Boobgate is still alive
and
well.
Oh, for the love of Christ, stop.
Yeah, they're still on the show.
There's no Boobgate in this one, I'm afraid. Although, you know, Kira's in it quite a lot.
I don't know.
She takes off her...
I was going to say, she takes her top off.
I know, and she's got the high-waisted pants on.
Yo, what is with those pants? I'm looking at them.
I have no idea.
Those pants are so unflattering.
Unless the 24th century's equivalent of the cheating pants. That's the only thing that I could think of.
They were like mom
grandma
pants.
Jeans.
Yeah. It was
all right, well, should we go straight into progress then?
Yes, let's do this.
A remote movie on the brink of destruction.
All the inhabitants were supposed to be evacuated by now.
If I leave here, I'll die.
A rebel leader refusing to surrender.
We'll have to beam him off the surface.
We'll be killing him.
Easy, Major.
And the Federation faces a mutiny within its own ranks.
Right now, she stands a pretty good chance of being out of uniform permanently.
No!
On the next Star Trek, Deep Space Nine.
I guess we could call her thing a mama form, you know, instead of like mom jeans.
We could.
Uniform, mama form.
All right. The episode that we're covering today is Progress. It was written by Peter Allen Fields, who created the $7 Million Man, trivia fan, and directed by Les Landau. Monty Markham. It's wild, Steve! Wild!
Overhearing a conversation at Quark's bar, Jake and Nog discover that Quark has been stuck with a huge supply of Cardassian yamuk sauce, which no one except Cardassians can stomach. Sensing an opportunity, Nog suggests that he and Jake can turn Quark's problem into a profit for themselves. Bewildered, Jake follows his friend's lead. In the meantime, station personnel are making preparations to assist the Bajorans in a massive energy transfer by tapping the molten core of its fifth moon, Gerarda. Kira and Dax make an orbital inspection of the moon from a runabout, hoping to confirm that all of Gerardo's inhabitants have been evacuated, but the sensors pick up signs of humanoid life forms, and Kira beams down to investigate. Materializing near a small cottage, Kira is confronted by a pair of Bajoran farmers brandishing threatening-looking farm implements. From inside the cottage comes a third Bajoran, who appears to be the spokesperson for the group. When Kira attempts to point out that they all should have been evacuated by now, he puts her off by inviting her to supper, and Kira, seeing no choice, sends Dax on and accepts the offer. On the station, Nog makes some initial queries and discovers that a Lysepian freighter captain who has dealings with the Cardassians would be willing to purchase the yamuk sauce. The captain counters Nog's request for 5 bars of gold-pressed latinum with an offer of a trade, 100 gross of self-stealing stem bolts. Nog reluctantly accepts, and then he and Jake tackle the problem of obtaining the yamuk sauce from Quark. As Kira helps prepare dinner with the farmer, Mullibok, she learns that he and his two friends, who were both rendered mute by the Cardassians, fled to the moon years ago to escape the Cardassian occupation of Bajor. Kira tries to explain to Mullibok that the three can now return to Bajor. What's more, if they remain on Gerardo, that once the energy transfer begins, then they will die. But Mullibok insists he'd rather die than leave his home. After a clever exchange with his uncle, Nog officially takes possession of the yamuk sauce, then exchanges it for the self-stealing stem bolts. He and Jake are at a loss as what to do with them, until it occurs to Nog that they can sell them, at a discount, to the Bajoran who initially ordered them from the Lysepian. Unfortunately, the Bajoran has no latinum either, and Nog and Jake are forced to accept 7 tessipates of land in exchange for the bolts. Kira explains the situation with Mullibok to Sisko and the Bajoran Energy Minister, hoping to find a compromise. But the minister stands firm. The project must proceed on schedule. Kira returns to Gerardo with 2 security guards and attempts to reason with the farmers, but the situation deteriorates quickly and Mullibok is injured by one of the guards. Kira calls for medical assistance and Bashir arrives to tend to Mullibok's wounds. With his two friends forcibly evacuated, Mullibok is the only remaining obstacle to the energy transfer project. Bashir offers to remove the Bajoran, but Kira declines and sends Bashir away. At last, Sisko travels to the moon and appeals to Kira as both her commander and her friend. Her career is on the line. Mullibok's fate is already decided, but hers isn't. That said, Sisko leaves her to her duty. As Kira ponders her responsibilities, Jake and Nog overhear another interesting conversation at Quark's bar. The Bajoran government wants to buy their land. Unfortunately, the government doesn't know that the owners are 2 young boys. They assume Quark is involved, and Quark makes it clear that he would like to be involved. Quickly, the two boys approach the Ferengi and offer to cut him in on a business opportunity that will only cost him 5 bars of gold-pressed latin. The next day, Kira makes her decision and tells Mullibok that he must leave Gerardo. The Bajoran refuses, declaring that as long as his cottage stands, he'll remain. Kira then sets fire to the cottage and tells Mullibok that it is time to get on with his life, but Mullibok says he'll die if he leaves. Kira assures him that he won't and reaches out to comfort him, but the old man shrugs off her hand. Saddened, Kira calls the runabout to beam them both up. And the synopsis was by Terry J. Erdman from the Deep Space Nine Compact. Think of this one, fellas.
Every time they said Gerardo, I was thinking of the Rico Suave guy from.
Yeah, sadly, I didn't know that was the name of the planet. And when you started mentioning that, that's all that was running through my head was that damn Rico Suave song.
And at this point, had the Praxis moon blown up yet? Well, yeah. Did they not learn anything from that? Yeah, we're gonna harvest this moon. Nothing bad could happen here.
Well, at least they evacuated the planet, though.
Yeah, well, see.
But I thought this was a flawed but solid episode. I enjoyed it. My biggest criticism of the episode is really a nitpick. My biggest criticism was if Quark had all that Yamak sauce, he would have seen the same opportunity that, that Nog did. It wouldn't have just, he wouldn't have just said, oh, throw it out, I don't care. He would have looked to trade it or sell it or get something out of it himself. He, you know, that he's a Ferengi. He's not going to just throw stuff out that he can get money for. So that was my biggest criticism, and it's kind of a nitpick because who cares how they got it? The whole point of that plot thread was just to show how they were wheeling and dealing like a Klinger on MASH.
Yeah. I thought that as well. I had that exact same thought. And then later on, I thought the conversation between Quark and Odo was really clumsy. They're having this big private conversation right in front of Nog and Jake just so the plot can move on.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
other than that, I really like this one. It's not a topic that they've not dealt with before. The forcible displacement of a populace for the greater good. They will deal with that again in future episodes. Probably better than this. But where this one scores for me is it's got Brian Keith in it. And I love Brian Keith. Brian Keith just makes everything better. And the great thing about this is it means that both Hardcastle and McCormick exist in the Star Trek universe. Because Daniel Hugh Kelly is in Star Trek Insurrection.
Oh, yeah. Mm. That's true. I forgot he was from that. And then, you know, I remember Brian Keith from when he was on Family Affair back in the 60s.
Well, maybe that was, what, Muffy and Jody with him?
Buffy.
Really?
She had Mrs. Beasley.
Mrs. Beasley.
And then their older sister was very creatively named Sissy.
But there was no Mr. French. There was no Mr. French on the planet.
That's the big thing. You know, he did compete with Sebastian Cabot, who is will forever be Pip from the Twilight Zone in my mind.
Oh.
So it's, you know, Brian Keith, there's a certain nostalgia factor when he's in anything. And he does bring some gravitas to the role. It almost seemed a little strange to me to see him in a science fiction part because I don't otherwise ever remember him playing in any type of science fiction show. But I thought he pulled it off well, and I thought he had, you know, he has enough charisma that he was showing, you know, that it worked in the scenes where he'd sit her down and he'd just start talking and just pull her in. And as the viewer, I felt like I was being pulled in as well, and I think that is more due to his own personal appeal as opposed to the way the script was actually written.
Yeah, well, in The Companion, Peter Allen Fields says that he doesn't actually like the way Brian Keith played it. He originally wrote Mullibok as being much more aggressive and much more manipulative than Brian Keith played it.
He plays it as charismatic and likable.
Yeah,
and
yeah. I disagree with the writer because I think the ending works better if he has likable traits, whereas if he's a bastard all the way through and manipulating Kira, the ending doesn't quite have the same impact.
Yeah,
if Kira's essentially burning down the house, thanks David Byrne, of a nice guy, then the ending has more impact. And now the visitor's brilliant in this one. She really is. Absolutely. Her and Brian Keith are really good.
Yeah, this is.
You can see when she burns it down, you could see that she does it with a very heavy heart. It's not something that she relishes doing. And if he were a bastard, I think, you know, she's got enough toughness in her that she would start to enjoy it. Like, you know, screw you, I'm going to burn down your house now, you bastard. But he is so likable and pulls her in so much that she believes in what he wants, but knows that the greater good has to be served, and she can't. You know, she can't indulge his wishes any longer and has to basically save his life because he will not win this battle.
This is a nice turning point for Kira, I think, in the show. This is a significantly better role for her than we saw in Battle Line. She was just, you know, overacting in this. I thought her acting was spectacular in this. She could basically relate to this character who was fighting against the officiary of Deep Space Nine and the Bajorans to try and displace them, and she had a sort of camaraderie with the person. I thought they worked out really well together, and you know, Kira taking her jacket off, yeah, she's even with her mom pants, she's pretty attractive. So
it's a momiform. Come on.
Yeah, but she also gets to do some light comedy in the bit with Jadzia at the beginning, where Jadzia talks about how she quite fancies Morn.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a great scene. I love that. She talks about the hairs on his head, back, or whatever, his neck.
And I guess that was also supposed to be, that wasn't supposed to be Jadzia actually saying that she found Morn necessarily attractive. It was just trying to sort of get Kira to loosen up, because Kira always seems to be kind of this, you know, she, especially in her relationship with Dax, she seemed very, you know, hard ass. And this was just, you know, Dax trying to loosen things up and try and get a conversation with her. So I liked that part. I liked that scene there. That was just a really fun scene between the two of them.
Yeah, and Jadzia trying to loosen Kira up is something that will carry on through the series. There's a scene, I can't remember what episode it's in. I think it's in the later on. It's when Worf's on board, where she texts her to the holodeck to just relax with a man in the holodeck, and Kira's just constantly moaning about being uncomfortable in a bathing suit, and why are we doing this, and what's all this for? And Jadzia's like, just relax, let the guy massage you, have fun. And she's like, what for? So that carries on, that Kira's uptight all of the time, and Jadzia's all about having fun when she's not on duty.
No, I think that was actually, now that I think about it, I think that was actually the episode we did for
Assistant Editor's Month
in Way of the Warrior, yeah. There, because we commented about, you know, how we enjoyed seeing them in their bikinis. I just remembered that fondly, sorry.
Boobgate makes a comeback.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but it's much better boobgate when you're talking Kira and Jadzia.
Yes, Kira and Jadzia, much better.
Mo better boobgate.
So
Bill, yeah, that's what you're on here, Bill.
Before we get far too sexist, self-stealing stem bolts will continue as a running gag throughout the series.
What do they do?
No, exactly. No one's
ever. You won't find finer ones in the galaxy.
You, no one ever knows what they do for the entire duration of the show. Everyone will be, what are they for?
They see, open and they close.
See, yeah. Supposedly the guy who was behind this, was it Peter Allen Fields?
Yeah.
Was kind of like the, Walter Jeffries of Deep Space Nine. He came up with all these interesting things. I think he was the one who came up with gold-pressed platinum. He was the person who came up with the self-sealing stem bolts. He's come up with all these sort of interesting things that now, you know, permeate the Star Trek universe. And he's, you know, I kind of look to him as the next generation version of Jeffries, you know, coming up with these sort of interesting little just one-off things that they use throughout the rest of the series. So that we're going to see this, you know, progress, this little one-off thing progress throughout the series is kind of neat here.
All that said, I think this was a fairly simple, straightforward episode. I think there's a lot to think about in the whole displacement of people, and like Andy said, it's a topic that we've seen before and we will see again. But I think this is really a character piece. I don't think this is so much that there's all that much going on. I don't really think there's that much going on at all. But it's a chance to see Kira interact with Brian Keithwaite, I forget his character's name now, and it's a chance to see Nog and Jake and you know their shenanigans.
Those playful scamps.
Yeah, but I think the thing with that is Jake and Nog were never irritating. I don't think they ever were. I mean, it's very easy to write irritating kids on Star Trek. Just look at any number of episodes of the original and Wesley. Mm-hmm. But Jake and Nog are likable.
Yes, I think they are, and I think this episode adds to that. I think it shows, you know, it shows them like on, you know, on their learning curve to, you know, to adulthood a little bit, where they're trying to negotiate with these people, and you see the, you know, they get the offer, and the two of them are looking at each other trying to figure out should we take it or not, and they have to try and be definitive, and I thought it was really well acted all around, and I think it's the first episode where I think the two younger actors kind of step up a little bit in their performances.
Well, I enjoyed the episode that we did, the storyteller one, and it might have just been that the storyteller aspect with Bashir and O'Brien down on the planet was such crap that the Jake and Nog part of it was actually enjoyable. But yeah, I think the two have definitely developed their characters a lot more, and they're starting to get the feel of each other down really well. So
I think Jake was a budding Lex Luthor there, because Nog goes, dirt!
Land! You know what my father said to me? Get out.
Get out.
After that, land. People are always going to need land, and they're going to pay through the nose to get it. You think it would have been better if he'd had all that line?
Yes. Everything's better with that line.
Definitely would have been better.
And Nog had had a conversation about Nogberg. It's an itty little bit of place, Mr. Cisco. Nogberg. Jadzia's got her own place.
No, it's just a little bitty place. To...
Now, I'm wondering how this all works out, because initially it was Rom who bought the Yamek sauce, and Quark was going to make him pay back for the Yamek sauce. But they, through all the shenanigans and finagling, they ended up selling it trading it for the land, and now Quark is going to pay them 5 bars of cold pressed latinum for the land, and he's going to make money. Is Rom still going to have to pay off for the Yamek sauce, or is this going to be
the Ferengi way?
I would say
yes.
I would say yes.
Rom still gets
given
screwed.
That technically Nog kind of finagled the Yamek sauce. I'm sure Quark could argue, well, that land's partially mine. I don't know how that would stand up in a court of law.
Even though that Quark said, "Yo, take it, get rid of it." If you're gonna, and he said he was gonna take it to the matter reclamation unit, so it's basically gonna turn it into whatever food stock.
Well, I presume Nog was smart enough to not tell him how they came upon owning the land.
Well, I mean. I don't think it would be that hard to trace it back if you were trying to figure that out.
I don't know.
No, but I think Quark's probably just looking at this and seeing balls of gold pressed latinum dancing in his eyes, and he's just seeing a way to turn a profit, and he's probably not thinking too hard about it.
Well, that's something I always question, is when they show Quark making a deal where he's naive in any way, because I think that doesn't go with his character. So I would think, you know, yeah, Quark is happy to get the land for 5 bars of gold pressed latinum, but he's still going to look beyond that and say, well, hey, if I look at this closer, I can get it for 3 bars or 2 bars or whatever, because I can say, you know, this was mine to begin with, or whatever. And I think he should be written where he's always looking to finagle more.
Yeah, I would have liked to see him say 3 bars. And then Jake and Nog say 4. Because it's presumably much easier for them to split 4 bars of gold pressed latinum between the two of them than it is 5.
Yeah, and the way I see it is if Quark believes the land is worth 10 bars, and he's thinking he's getting a steal at 5, he's not going to just say, okay, I'll give you 5. He's still going to try and knock it down and say, oh, I'll give you 4.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to still see if he can get an even better deal. Well, so that's the thing, is I always want to see my Ferengis, I want to see them always constantly trying to haggle to get better.
Well, and it also could have been that this is still early on in the development of the Ferengi character and the Ferengi mindset, that the whole, you know, the acquisition of profit or the acquisition of things is just sort of starting out here. So we're not getting specifically how deep that Quark should be into doing that, this far, this early on in the ship.
I'm gonna respectfully disagree on that, because I think, you know, we already had the Nagus on there. We're already hearing about the rules of acquisition. We already have, you know, basically the focus of this is, you know, Nog trying to take care of an opportunity. So I think they've established that these are profit-seeking people. And I think that should, you know, at this point, at a minimum, that should be the focus, and maybe they can make it a little deeper if they can, but that much I think was established right from the start, and I think it wasn't done in this only because it would have just lagged, you know, would have dragged it down a little bit. It would have added time to it, and they didn't really have enough time for the B plot to do it. I don't even think it's that they neglected to think of it. I think it's just so obvious that they would have, but I also think that they just, you know, they needed to move it along, and they didn't want Quark to be the focus of anything. It really was Nog's spotlight at that point.
Okay. Oh, one of the notes that I had that I wanted to kind of talk about was the conversation that Sisko and Kira had down on the planet. I like the way that their characters are finally developing, and I especially like that Sisko had a call back to the first time that they met in the pilot episode, where he said that, you know, he thought that she was brash and irritating, and that, but now that he's grown to trust her and he's actually looking out for her, especially when She goes down to care for Mullaback on the planet after Bashir had come down, after he got hit by the phaser, and she was there. You know, Sisko basically told, Bashir, make sure that she's taking an extended leave for a couple of days, write it up and make it happen so that she could work these things out, because
I love that scene
that he's finding a way to delay it by making a medical, by making a medical emergency or making a medical condition for this having to happen. So yeah. I like that Sisko is trusting of his first officer now, and that their relationship is growing from how it was in the pilot episode.
Love the way he did that. I love the way he said, I've not given any such order. And Sisko went, yet. But you're about to. And Bashir's so slow, it takes him a minute to twig what he's talking about.
Bashir in this first season is just the most annoying character to me. I'm about sick of him, and I'm ready for him to get his comeuppance. We'll see that next on the next episode. We'll see his comeuppance, in my opinion.
Yeah, I thought he really fell a little flat this episode. It's like, oh, I don't know if it's just the acting or the way he was written, and that whole scene. It's like, does Sisko have to just smack you in the face to get you to go along with this? Like, wake up, man! What's wrong with you?
Well, I think it's demonstrating the difference between this show and the other shows, in that Bashir's a very by the book Starfleet officer, and Sisko is quite willing to bend the rules when he has to, which is very much in the Captain Kirk mold. He never actually breaks a rule, but if he can twist it and bend it ever so slightly to get what he wants, he's more than happy to do that. And Bashir at this point isn't there yet. He still thinks everything's apples and candy sauce and great things.
Starfleet regulations.
Yeah, he's not quite at that point. He's not a seasoned officer yet. O'Brien would have got it straight away.
Yes. O'Brien would have probably already been two steps ahead of Sisko on it.
Yeah, probably. So, yeah, it works. Yeah, but she is very annoying in this first year. But I think that ultimately, when you look at the series as a whole, actually contributes to his character growth.
The point where Sisko says to Kira, where he points out to her that now it's tough being on the other side of the equation, it was really heartfelt from her, that where she's like, yes, it is. That, where she's the one pushing people off their land now, instead of, she's the Cardassian in this equation, whereas before she was the victim. But now she's the aggressor, and she's having a hard time dealing with that whole dynamic. So that kind of really developed Kira a little more, her character.
It goes to what Paul was saying. It's a very important character piece from Kira's standpoint. And I think she's the one who goes through the greatest character arc in the first season, because she has to stop thinking like a Bajoran freedom fighter and start thinking like a military officer. And it's very difficult for her. And I don't think we see this better than in this show, and one that we've got coming up in a couple of weeks. And I think it's at this point that Nana Visitor starts rising to the challenge of playing Kira. Because we've mentioned there is an earlier episode where she was a little bit over the top in her line delivery. And I think this one gives her the character. And from this point on, she knows how to play her. And I think she does it exceptionally well.
Yep, I agree.
Same here.
Right. Yeah. So I think the problem... We're all in agreement this week, which is quite sad. I like it when we fight with each other. I think the problem that we've got with this, with covering every single episode, is every now and again you're going to come across an episode like this where it's well written and it's exceptionally well acted and there's good character growth, but ultimately it's just an okay episode. It's not bad. It's not great. It doesn't suck in any way. Certainly not as much as the Alan Moraine one. But we've not ended up with a lot to say about it.
I think that's kind of what we'll probably have, is the good episodes, unless they're just spectacularly good, they'll just be like, that was enjoyable. I don't think this is necessarily going to be a memorable episode, but it was good. So, and if that's what you can get from Star Trek, then I'll take it. I don't mind. I would much rather have a decent episode that's somewhat forgettable than a crap episode like the Alamarine one.
Yeah, and it's exactly like Paul said earlier on as well. There is the subtext there that we've talked about of the displacement of people from the home. But that's not banged over your head in this episode. Some of the worst episodes of Trek is when they take on an issue and just pummel you in the face with it. This one's actually very subtle in that that's just an undercurrent. And I love the ambiguity of the ending of this episode. Does he go with her, or does he stay there and die? Does he resent her forever for what she did, or does he ultimately come to the conclusion she did the wrong thing for the right reasons? And we never find out. We never see Brian Keith's character again, because he didn't live much longer than this episode. Unfortunately, he took his own life a couple of years later. So we never see that character again, and we never learn the outcome. And I much prefer when Star Trek does ambiguity, like we've mentioned the Private Little War before, when they have an ending where they're not sure that what they've done is the right thing to do, and they leave the audience to ponder it. So there is some food for the mind going on in this one, but like Paul says, it's primarily a Kira character piece and a Jake and Nog character piece.
I think, you know, we saw enough of his character to know he's never going to totally forgive her for what she did.
No.
But I don't think... I think his character was portrayed in a way where he was three-dimensional enough. He wasn't just a cardboard cutout of a guy who didn't want to leave. That you could see where I think, and, you know, like you said, they leave it to your own imagination, basically. I do think that, you know, she would get him to leave, and he would acclimate himself to whatever he had to, because he was a survivor, but that he would never totally accept the fact that he was, you know, there would always be a resentment there for what occurred.
I have a slightly different take maybe on Brian Keith's character. He's been a fighter his whole life, so giving up and leaving is not in his nature. So did he really want, maybe he wanted her to force him off the planet, I mean the moon, then actually he didn't want to give in and just leave. He, you know, maybe he was actually subtly pushing her to do what she did, to make a stand and force him to leave, that he wouldn't just leave. He wouldn't acquiesce and just go on his own. He was going to have to be forced off. That's the only way he's going to leave, like he said, because he dug all the trenches by hand and chewed the dirt with his, you know, put the nutrients in the dirt with it, whatever, that crazy speech he had. But, you know, maybe he was actually forcing her to do that. Maybe he wanted to leave, but he couldn't. His own moral code wouldn't let him just leave. He had to be forced off, even though he knew that's what he needed to do. That's what he should do. He couldn't let himself do it. He had to be forced by someone else. Maybe that's a stretch.
I don't think, from what I saw of the character, that he was the type to ever accept the inevitability of a situation. That he always thought he didn't believe in the no-win scenario. So I don't think he would ever say, "Yeah, I know I have to leave, but I'm going to make them make me." I don't think he would ever accept the fact that he knows he has to leave. And he was certainly, very clearly in my mind, willing to die in order to stay there.
Yeah, that's why, even though she says to beam up at the end, I'm not entirely convinced he went with her.
I think they just beamed them up at that point. This is my take on it, is they just beamed them up at that point. He didn't have a say-so in it, and that's why he'd go.
Yeah, but again, like you said, since we don't see him being beamed up, there's that ambiguity of the episode. Mm-hmm. So you're left to think, well, did he come peacefully? Did he acclimate to living on Bajor, or did he do something after he was beamed up? Did he attack Kira on the runabout? This is all left up to the viewer's imagination, which is sometimes the best way that a story can be told. You know, by allowing the viewer to mull it around their own head and make their own decisions for the story. So,
and I like the presentation of them, you know, like you said, you know, they're becoming the Cardassians, they're displacing people. And yes, they're doing it in a far, far more humane way, you know, that they're letting him stay to acclimate himself to the thought, and to, you know, to give him a chance to do it on his own, of his own accord. But they are ultimately the ones forcing them to leave, you know, the place that is his home. You know, I like the moral ambiguity there that they're put into, you know, that of looking at the greater good and basically, you know, again, being more gentle and kind about the way they're doing it, but doing what the Cardassians did to them. I think that gives us some subtext in the episode that you know we haven't seen in every episode so far. And while this may be a somewhat forgettable episode, I think it's very solid.
Well, why couldn't they move people to the moon? It seems like such a nice place to live. You know, that they're saying, you know, we have people on the planet that need this. Well, maybe you've got this lovely moon here and you're going to destroy it.
Well, you got to think there's much less living area on the moon.
Well.
So, do we have anything else? Do we want to give ratings for this?
Yeah, I think, yeah. We're ready to rate them. Andy, okay. It's your episode. Why don't you go first?
This is a tough one. I want to give it 3 as an episode. It's exactly like we've discussed. It's a good, solid episode, but I don't think it's a classic. But I kind of want to give it an extra bar just for Brian Keith. Alright, we'll settle on 3.5, even though we never give halves on this show.
Oh,
we give halves all the time.
We give halves all the time.
And every time we have this conversation. And we're just going to do this every time I make that joke now. Yeah, all right. I'll settle for 3.5, but the half is purely for Brian Keith.
There you go.
I'm also at 3.5 on it, and I have no problem with saying I'm giving a little bump for Brian Keith because that's what the episode is. You know, you're giving the rating for what the episode is, not for just the writing, just for the directing, just for the acting, or just for the world building. It's everything on a whole. The way I see it is 3 is an average episode. If we're going on a scale of 1 to 5, 3 is dead set in the middle. This is a little better than average because it's got things that we talked about, including Brian Keith. So I'm at 3.5 as well.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and give it a 3. I enjoyed it. I liked Brian Keith. I think he had a nice balance of caring and grumpiness. I really enjoyed Kira's character arc. You know, we're seeing her character develop a lot, and seeing her have to deal with her suddenly becoming like the thing that she most hated. Her having to sort of take on the guise of a Cardassian really, really helped her character through arc in the show. So, but overall, yeah, it's not going to be one of the most memorable episodes. So I'm giving it a 3.
All right, I'm going to interject some controversy into...
1!
No.
No, it's not that bad.
No. One of my last ratings when I was on was for Vortex, and I think I gave that a 3.75.
Yes, you did.
Yes.
You
know,
Sean, keeper of the spreadsheet.
Yes, you did.
Now, I cannot in good conscience give Vortex a higher grade than... listen to me. This has been bugging me. Not soon after that recording, I'm just thinking, why did I give that a 3.75? Why? Because now I've gone back and seen other episodes and went, no, that did not deserve a 3.75. So I would like to retroactively change my grade on Vortex.
Sorry, no. Not allowed.
To a 2.75.
Nope.
I'm sorry, I cannot edit past Excel files. Too bad. Still,
I know, but we can maybe change our opinion when we get to the end of the first season.
Okay.
It's on the internet, so you can't change it.
Damn it, I'm changing.
The internet has spoken.
Well, then, if I can't, I have to give this a 3.75, because I can't give this a lower grade than... So I guess all my episodes are going to be 3.75 from this point, because I can't go lower than Vortex.
It's going to mess up our grade point average.
That's what I'm saying. So you better go back and retroactively change that to 2.75.
How does that help our grade point average?
Because I want to give this a 3.25.
Wait, I thought you said you were giving it a 3.75.
Well, that's I have to give that if you don't retroactively change the other
one. Oh, for the love of...
Alan Moraine!
It's a 2.75. Battle, okay.
You let him on the show.
Vortex is a 2.75 now, Bill. Are you happy?
Yes, because now I can give this a 3.25. I'm for Brian Key.
Please put an asterisk next to that and write under Paul's protest. Because I don't even have a spreadsheet. I just have a little notebook here that I put it in, and I don't like even changing that.
This is my... This is my version of Who's on First, Deep Space Nine.
Oh, all right. Well, now we've graded it all. Should we do emails?
So wait a minute. Vortex and Progress are both 2.75 now.
Yes.
Wait, no.
He's not the highest paid podcaster on True True Freaks or nothing.
Okay, like Vortex was 2.75. I thought Progress was 3.25.
Oh God.
Yeah, this one.
Ah.
This one is 3.25.
Okay.
3.25. Oh, and I got to change it again.
Get an eraser, you schlub.
Hate you, Bill.
Fine, you can beat me
I expect you to give him tons of shit on the next Back to the Bench.
What else is new?
This is what you need to do, Paul.
If he ever comes back on Back to the Bench.
Oh.
he's getting the Scott syndrome. He hasn't been on the list.
One week.
2 weeks. 2 weeks.
What do you mean 2 weeks?
You looked at me.
Okay. You weren't on the episode.
The air. Is she crazy?
You weren't on the episode I did last week, and you weren't on the episode I did this week. So
it'll
that's
still be 2 weeks.
Days
till I say I'm sorry.
Girls, you're all pretty. Emails.
Incoming transmission.
Let's get the
episode wasn't ending there because you could just have us babbling on and fade out.
Who wants to do the first email tonight? I'll take the second one.
Okay, I'll do Gene Hendricks.
Are you sure your voice is up to it?
Yeah, I can do it. It's no problem. Gene Hendricks writes in with the title Passenger. He says Andy, Paul, and Sean. So there you go. You get second billing this time, Paul.
I can live with second. That's
okay.
Right.
He says, this is the first episode that you guys have covered that I haven't rewatched recently, and now I'm regretting that. It sounds like the acting and story are just not up to snuff. It almost sounds like a Naked Now scenario where it's too early in the run of the show to be swapping out personality characters, but that's just from your description. I'm glad that my email caused an impromptu English language and Hollywood pay grade discussion. It's always nice to contribute a little bit on non-sequitur to the show. I don't remember what the English language and Hollywood pay grade discussion was. Do either of you remember what came from that?
When this email came in, I did remember, but I don't anymore. It's been a little while since the email came in and the episode aired.
Sorry, Gene. We're getting old and forgetting things. Sorry.
We've also got a lot of these in the back. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so you know, when you hear this and we're talking about Justin Lin and us not knowing who the writer is, the film will probably already be made. It's probably
in fact, the film is already out on Blu-ray.
Yeah, so. So Star Trek 3, go through the Two True Freaks link to pick it up. But Gene, if you didn't know, does a bunch of podcasts over at Two True Freaks. He does the Hammer Strikes podcast, the Quantum Cast, Anime Freaks, and he also does Legends of the Superheroes. Check all those out over at Two True Freaks.
The next email tonight is... Hold on, my phone has turned itself off, so I have to go back into it. The next email tonight comes from Professor Allen, who also does a number of podcasts all over at the Relatively Geeky site. Go and check those out. Boring versus bad is his description of our show. Oh no, sorry, that's his email subject heading. I do apologize. Deep Space Dudes, Professor Allen says. In episode 9, you three had a difference in opinion on the episode. You all agreed that it wasn't good, but Andy was more positive about the episode in the sense that at least it wasn't boring. Except for the rock climbing, of course. As Emily and I recently discussed with Sean on Who True Freaks, ding! The cardinal sin in TV is to be boring. I can forgive goofy and even inconsistent, especially this early in a show's existence, for ambitious or fast-paced. It sounds like this episode tried something, failed big, but at least it wasn't boring. That's not success, but it's something. I'm glad that each of you bring your own opinions to the episodes. Don't ever stop that. There are some fandoms that I'm aware of where diverting from the acceptable, politically correct opinions is the surest way to ridicule or worse. And I don't want to be any part of a fandom like that. You guys continue to be yourselves, because for the majority of you, that's a good thing. I'd like to know which of us he doesn't think that's a good thing for.
It's... I'll take it.
What I appreciate about that is that yeah, we don't ridicule each other for diverting from the acceptable politically correct answers. We ridicule each other for everything.
Yeah, we're equal opportunity mockers.
Yeah, we don't mind. You know, if we think someone else is being stupid, we'll call them on it.
Hey,
Hey. I do want to address the point of his email, though, which is it better to be a failure but a noble failure than boring, which I totally agree with him on. I would much rather have something at least attempt to be different than just be boring and dull.
Well, yeah,
and,
but...
You know, I don't think that one was boring or dull. I don't think it was good, but I don't think it was dull. And, you know...
I can dull. Abide by that. I'll go ahead.
I was going to say, dull will just cause me to fall asleep during it, and that, you know, this one didn't cause me to fall asleep. I think we're talking about Move Along Home here.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was bad. That's why I gave it one star. Well, one bar of gold pressed platinum. So, yeah, I guess it's better than being bad and boring. You know, boring and exciting is better than boring and dull. But not boring and dull. Excuse me. Yeah. Bad and exciting is better than bad and dull. But bad is still bad, and you know, it's just throwing some an action sequence in it isn't going to resurrect it at all. So.
No, but I think there are more boring episodes to come up, even though I don't think there are necessarily worse ones.
I have to agree with the professor. Yeah, a triumphant failure is a lot more interesting than just an average boring show. I would rather see something that attempted to try and do something innovative or interesting or different from the norm than rather one that just sort of skirts along and plays it you know, pretty close to the cuff and is just uninteresting. So, but unfortunately we're talking about Move Along Home, which I think we all pretty much agree was crap. So it doesn't matter boring, bad, it was all of those things.
But, yeah, I was quite happy to take the position of being the one that tried to defend it, but, you know, I wasn't defending it because I thought it was good.
Well, we admire you.
If you think about it, a lot of the criticism of the recent Trek movies are that, you know, they've sacrificed some storyline for the sake of being exciting. And you know, I mean, that's a problem. It's one that even I, who like the two movies, would have to say, yeah, that, you know, maybe we should put a little bit more effort into some depth of character and story and a little bit less into exciting. I want exciting, like I said when we talked earlier about the next movie, but I don't want it at the expense of other aspects of it. I want a well-rounded story all around.
Okay. Yeah, good emails this week. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you'd like to write into the show, the email address is listentotheprofits@gmail.com. We love getting emails from listeners. Thanks, everyone, for writing in. So, well, since we're finished up, do we want to get it next time? What's coming up?
Next time on an all-new episode of Listen to the Prophets, if wishes were horses, beggars would ride.
Visit our website at twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Two True Freaks and all of its excellent affiliates are available on iTunes, and you can choose to subscribe to either the entire network if you wish, or pick whichever individual shows you want to follow. We have so many shows to choose from, there's just bound to be one that appeals to your particular fandom. Just search Two True Freaks with an exclamation mark at the end, space, and the number 2.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks?
If you've enjoyed our show, please, won't you take a moment to rate us on iTunes? That helps others find the show, too.
Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
about it anyway.
Okay. Alright, what Andy was doing, and I guess he does this with Steven over at the Fantastic
House. Andy does in the privacy of his own house.
No.
That was earlier on.
Nice. What he says he does is he and Steven...
What Andy says he does.
Shut up. Shut up.
This is comfortable with
it. Yeah. I'm not playing Dr. Bill today. I'm sorry. But
I always need a Dr. Bill around. I'm
okay,
sorry.
Well, I will take that place then. I've heard another show say that they do it. They just do sort of a, they have one person go sort of a tapping, and they just, you know, they do a count to like 3, 2, 1, and then everyone says something staccato, like go or whatever, cock, I don't know, whatever.
See, what I heard, everybody sings a song first.
See, I've heard that they all do the nursery rhyme for Move Along Home.
Oh God, I'm going back to bed.
Good night.
Oh, you guys are funny. I've missed you.